consistent, and it's just a lot of new perspectives and a lot of new questions, which I've only just really started to think about. Okay, so so the first topic is non-commutative geometry. By which I mean in the sense of Alan Kohn, so studying the Dirac operator, basically, in some suitable mathematical setting. Dirac operator. And the second subject is quantum non-commutative geometry. So whereas non-commutative geometry is really the study of individual geometries, and you can think of them as just like classical geometries, only they're more general, but they have the same, they play the same role as a classical geometry. So there's nothing particularly quantum about a non-commutative geometry. But in quantum non-commutative geometries, the idea is we're kind of integrating over or averaging over geometries. In the sense of a functional integral. So in fact, there's an arrow going here, which is to do a functional integral. The third subject is Google there already, that I've thought about for a very long time is state sum models. And these are ones which are topological. So topological invariance is important here. So like some of the models that you get in quantum gravity, for example, in three-dimensional quantum gravity, the Ponsano-Reggi model is an example of such a state sum model, although that's not the one I'm going to talk about. And so the idea is that, in fact, there's a strong relation between non-commutative geometry and state sum models, which I hope to explain somewhere in the talk. So in fact, there's an arrow going, well, to particular types of state sum models. If you start with a non-commutative geometry, you can construct one. And in fact, the other way around, you can go backwards. If you have a certain type of state sum model with the appropriate mathematical gadgets in it, you can reconstruct non-commutative geometry. And then finally, so there's another arrow in this. So this is diagram calculus. So as you know, if you start with some sort of algebra, I mean, in quantum gravity, for example, we start with a group or something, and then we do a diagram calculus to form its category of representations, which we think of diagrammatically, and that turns into a state sum model. So it's that sort of thing going on there. And then the final arrow in this picture is Feynman diagrams. So I'll get to explain that. And these aren't really mathematical arrows. Well, they're slightly mathematical, but they're not. You shouldn't think of starting here and going all around the picture and coming back to where you started. Although perhaps one day we'll be able to do that. It's more that particular examples I can start with here and get examples of things here, and then if you maybe add a few conditions, I can get to down here, and then some of what you get down here you can compare with what you get that way and put it together and make something else and so on. So it's not a commutative diagram, or anything. Although perhaps it should be. Perhaps one day it will be. And I should mention my co-workers before I forget to say. So co-workers whose results I will mention at some point in the talk. So there's Sarah Tavares. And she worked on the state sum model aspect. And there's a paper in CMP and a thesis of hers, also on the archive. So that's down here. And there's Lisa Glaser, who's been working on the quantum non-commutative geometry, and particularly doing Monte Carlo simulations. And it's a project that's really just started, so I'm going to mention very briefly some of her results. But if you want the full thing, you should go to see her talk at Loops conference, which will be the world premiere of that stuff, I guess. Okay, so now I can try the board technology. Okay, so it's so far away I can't even point to it. But okay, try. Okay, so the first thing is to talk about the non-commutative geometry itself. So that's the top left vertex of the triangle. And I'm going to use what are known as real spectral triples, in fact, finite ones. So I'm going to introduce various aspects of this as I go along. I'm not going to give a complete definition here because that would eat up too much time. but roughly, you have a Hilbert space. Which you think of as sort of a one particle space, if you like, physics terms. And the finite here means this is finite dimensional. And then you have a Dirac operator. And the third thing of the triple is an algebra. So algebra of operators acting in H. And you can think of this, well, very roughly, it's the generalization of the functions. You have a classical manifold. You have the functions on the manifold. They form a commutative algebra. Well, this thing sort of replaces that. And the difference is it's allowed to be non-commutative. That's why it's non-commutative geometry. It's somewhat misleading to think of this as still as the algebra of functions. Firstly, if you have a non-commutative algebra, they're not the functions on any space in the usual sense. But also in non-commutative geometry, this algebra plays more roles than just the functions. It also tells you about the transformations of the space. So, yes, question.
That's the real repression.
Sorry, what?
The real repression.
Oh, yeah, okay, so there's a bit more data.
Sorry, what is the role of H in usual case? Because in usual case, we have the space of functions.
It will be the L2 spinners on the manifold.
But you could do geometry without doing L2 spinners.
Sorry, what?
Yeah. So you can do geometry without referring to spinners.
Yeah, so you have a spin manifold and you look at the L2 space of spinners, mm-hmm. and then the Dirac operator acts on spinners to spinners, right?
So you don't have a spin structure on your manifold?
Manifold with a spin structure, yeah.
Well, if you don't have one.
Oh, then this doesn't work.
So you cannot recover Riemannian geometry with no spin structure?
Well, there's a generalization in which you can do that, but I'm not talking about that. Okay, and the real bit means there's two extra pieces of information. Well, let's go here. So real. So it means there's a chirality operator. Well, actually, real is really this thing here. There's an antilinear operation called the real structure. This is antilinear. So in physics, the chirality just tells you the eigenvalues are plus or minus one and tell you the left-handed and right-handed particles. And the real structure is the charge conjugation in physics.
Seems like this would depend on dimension and the details.
Yeah, the details depend on dimension.
So Re means J squared equal plus 1?
Usually
Re means J squared equal plus 1. Usually Re means J squared equal plus 1.
Plus 1. And now it can be plus 1 or minus 1. Yeah. So all this data is what we call a geometry.
It's real or complex.
In fact, I'm calling it a matrix geometry. So the classical geometries will be in the case where H is infinite dimensional and the algebra is commutative. So I've made two changes. I'm making the algebra non-commutative, making H finite dimensional. And the idea is it approximates a... the usual geometry, usual manifolds. That's the idea, anyway. Yeah.
What's the physical interpretation of the commuting geometry, which is the limit?
Space-time.
Just space, but the ordinary space, GR space.
Well, if you're doing gravity, yes. If you're, space-time. If you want to do particle physics as well, you need some bit that remains non-commutative, and that gives you your gauge groups and things. Why am I interested in this finite condition here, this finite dimensional thing? And the idea is that the finiteness is to do with the Planck scale cutoff. That's the idea. And so what happens when you do this? So if you're thinking of this as like the space of spinners on a manifold, how can that be finite dimensional? Well, the answer is if there's a cutoff in the momentum, so that you don't have modes of infinitely high energy. That's what leads you normally to having infinite dimensional Hilbert space. So, you know, physically we want this. We're trying to do quantum gravity and there should be a cutoff. So, yeah, hey, let's put it in.
You have an infrared cutoff too, then?
Right, yes. Okay, so so let's do an example. So just to make sure that everything is concrete and you can all see what I'm talking about, I'll describe an example of a non-commutative geometry, and that's the fuzzy sphere. So here we fix a natural number n, and then the Hilbert space is C4 tensor the n by n matrices, MNC, so the complex matrices n by n. And the Dirac operator is the following thing. So we take gamma 0 tensor 1, and then add following sum over j and k, with j less than k from 1 to 3. And these are Dirac gamma matrices, in fact, just as Dirac almost had them. So like that. So the gammas are the usual gamma matrices that act in C4, and the one acts in on the n-bone matrices, or here the commutator with the LJKs acts on the n-bone n matrices. So the Ls are n-bone matrices themselves. And for this fuzzy sphere, they are simply the generators of rotations in the n-dimensional representation. So there's three of those generators. Yeah, so let's be precise about the gamma matrices. So gamma naught squared is 1 here, and the gamma I squared are minus 1. So I is 1 to 3. So the usual thing. And because there's three of one and one of the other, there's the signature of this Clifford algebra. So it's 3 minus 1 is 2. So it turns out in this non-commutative geometry game, and actually in a lot of mathematics of this sort of geometry, it's actually the signature that plays a big role in the algebraic properties of your geometry. And this thing is trying to approximate a two-dimensional sphere, which in Riemannian geometry you'd think of a two-dimensional space as having signature 2, 0, and 2 minus 0 is 2, and this is the same 2, you see. So that's why it looks a bit odd using signature 3, 1 gamma matrices, but actually they have the same signature as the space you're trying to approximate. So that's why everything's fine. Robert?
Why do you take C4?
That's what works. I'll explain a bit more in a minute. So the chirality operator is the usual thing. It's what gets called gamma 5. So as you know, this has eigenvalues plus and minus 1. Tells you what the left and right-handed things are. And the real structure is the charge conjugation operator for the spinners, and then it's Hermitian conjugation for the n by n matrices. So star is Hermitian conjugate. And there's one thing missing from here, and that's the algebra. So I need space to, let's put that here. The algebra is the n by n matrices. So that's a nice, easy thing. And it acts on the Hilbert space just by left multiplication. So an algebra element acting on M, sorry, V tensor M is just V tensor A M. Okay, so V in here, M in there. And then, in fact, there's a nice calculation you can do. Calculate the following thing. Do J, A star, J inverse, acting on V tensor M, well, just focus on what happens to M here. So this this J inverse, well, the inverse of star is star, so it takes the Hermitian conjugate, then it multiplies by the left by the A star, and then this will take the Hermitian conjugate again. So the net result is that A acts on the right. So this is. So in fact, we call this the left action of the algebra. And this other one is the right action. And it's a standard thing in non-commutative geometry that there's always a left action and a right action of your algebra. And that comes from the properties of the real structure J. And it's true in the standard model of particle physics as well, that all the fermions live in a bimodule. There's a left action of an algebra acting and there's a right action of the algebra acting. So when you look at it in the right way, grinning away there. Okay, so what can we say about this Dirac operator here? So what's the result? Yeah, so D has the spectrum. Of two fermion fields, on a sphere, so remember, you know, when you have a two sphere and you ask for Dirac spinners on S2, they'll have two dimensional fiber, so you have two dimensional spinners. So a fermion field on S2 has spinners, probably C2. So, you know, this C4 here obviously led to that's why I've got two spinner fields, because that's split into two C2s. Okay, it's the spectrum of two fermion fields on S2, but cut off at, well, one of them has a maximum eigenvalue at n plus 1, and the other one has maximum eigenvalue at n. So they're almost the same, but not quite. So somebody asked, Florian asked, why do I have C4? Well, the answer is that if you try and do this with C2, and there's literature about this version of this construction of C2, it doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is because in the non-commutative geometry, you can't cut apart these two fermion fields. In the classical limit, they kind of decouple. And you could, in the classical limit, see, in the classical limit, you have bundles on a sphere. And in fact, the bundle of spinners, this bundle of spinners is trivial, but if you take the plus and the minus eigenspaces, you know, the left and right-handed things, they form non-trivial bundles over the sphere. And so when if you try and do this cutting, you'd be trying to sort of cut non-trivial bundles on the sphere over apart. And you can't do that in this finite dimensional context. If you just have matrices, trying to cut non-trivial bundles apart is just impossible. So something would break if you try and do this with C2. And what actually breaks is a no chirality operator if you do C2. Which it precisely tells you can't see any more of the difference between the left and the right-handed things, because you can't somehow model this non-trivial bundle. Okay, so this is all in a paper called Matrix Geometries and blah, 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 this construction. So let me just say this. So this doubling is a necessary feature. And it also seems to be generic, at least in a certain sense, I'll explain in a minute. Well, it could well be, yes, that you can think of it that way, because in this finite dimensional setting, the index of the Dirac operator is always zero. And I think if you could cut it apart, you'd find an index that wasn't zero. So that's sort of why. And I think that's the same reason on a lattice, but I'm not really an expert on that. So yeah, possibly there's something that's common there. Okay, so now that you can think of a generalization, of the fuzzy sphere. So basically the same setup, but I'm just going to write down a more general formula for the Dirac operator as follows. Same basic setup. but here H is a Hermitian. Matrix. And the L, J, K's are now in here, they're anti-Hermitian. But otherwise, they're arbitrary. So what you see here is the fuzzy sphere is a particular example of this general construction, where these are now the rotation generators, and this thing is a half. But now there's a whole space here of these geometries, you see. And this is what I need for the quantum theory. and so what we say is that D is in some space of geometries, curly G. And it's actually a vector space. Geometries. So the Dirac operator depends linearly on this free data here. And the free data, these form a vector space, so there's a vector space of these. So you can draw a little picture of your space of geometries. There's obviously the origin here, zero, the zero Dirac operator. Pretty degenerate. And there's the fuzzy sphere here. And then there's all the other ones. And of course, there's a whole line of geometries, which are just rescaling the fuzzy sphere, which also have spherical symmetry. But most of the ones out here don't have spherical symmetry. So in fact, you know, these are fixed points of the rotation group acting on everything here, whereas the other ones, there'll be orbits of some sort. So you can actually classify all possible Dirac operators. And in fact, a formula like this is the most general. This isn't quite the most general formula here, but there's a formula much like this, which is the most general. And again, it's a linear space. So here's the general form. D acting on some element V tensor M I'm putting V and M in because, you see, this thing is some matrix acting on the left here, and then the other piece is some is the same matrix acting on the right. It's the same thing, but with K star acting on the right. So the omegas are some products of gamma matrices. And the Ks are hermitian or anti-hermitian as necessary. But that's it. And I want to write, so I want a bit of notation here. I want to write this as, what's my notation? Yeah, I want to write this as theta. You see, as far as the matrix bit is concerned, everything just acts on the left. So it commutes with things acting on the right. That's the point about this. And whereas this thing here acts on the right, so it commutes with things acting on the left.
Does D have to satisfy compatibility condition with respect to J?
Yeah. So this, yeah, so D commutes with J. Okay. And from that, of course, because J switches left action into right action, it means this thing here is determined by theta. So this is just J theta, J inverse, this piece here. Okay. So that's non-commutative geometry. That's all you need to know.
That space that you just described, can you, if you take the limit n to infinity, so I guess some of this geometry becomes usual geometry and some don't. Can you say something about
right? So
how dense it is or what's known?
Yeah. So so the way you should think about this is that if you think about the limit of n going to infinity, is that some of the matrices in your algebra here, so this is a good way of thinking about it. The matrices that are very nearly diagonal, very nearly commute. And then when you take the limit n to infinity, they commute better and better, and they end up as the algebra of functions on some space. So that's the way you should think about it. Turning that into a theorem is non-trivial, and I think I know how to do it, but I haven't actually done it. But there's a literature on these fuzzy spaces, and people do things like this limit I'm talking about. You see, the fuzzy literature started off without a Dirac operator. It started off with this algebra here, and usually with no spinners, with just this as sort of scalar fields, and sometimes with a Laplace operator or something. And in that context, people have talked about this limit. So, a fair bit is known, but not precisely in this Dirac operator framework.
Now, can you get, suppose you want to get a curve, not just the round sphere, but some other metric?
Yeah, I don't know how to do that. Yeah.
Do you know how to do that?
Well, I think I know how to do a variety of spaces, but they all have various degrees of symmetry of some sort. So I don't know how to do a general sort of potato shape with a lump sticking out the side. No. But I'm going to assume for the purposes of this talk that can be done.
Mm-hmm. Yes. When you replace the rotation generators by a more general matrix, that's what was going on, isn't that right?
That's the idea. That's what I want you to believe. But,
but can you prove it?
Whether it's,
in what sense is that
right.
True?
So the obvious project would be just to rescale some of these and say, is this a fuzzy ellipsoid? So that would be a good starting point. So if somebody wants a project to do, please let me know if that works. Yes.
I can see why you need the Dirac.
No. Yeah, go.
I can see why you need the Dirac operator, because that's giving you the metric information.
Right.
But why do you need the chirality? Why did you need it to be, have a well-defined handedness or something like that? What is that doing for us from the physics point of view?
Well, physics is chiral, so we do have left and right-handed particles, and they are different.
It's true that if you wanted to get the standard model, you might describe this, but suppose you just wanted to get
Newtonian
geometry.
Well, we don't. What we want to get is a limit in which you actually have a manifold with spinners on it, with a chirality operator. So we want to be able to take a limit of you know, left-handed elements of this Hilbert space, and then in the end to infinity limit, we'll get actually left-handed spinner fields on the manifold.
Okay, but suppose you just wanted to do sort of pure quantum gravity without
right.
worrying about...
Oh, then I can't help you.
Would there be a version of this that didn't have the...
It didn't have, well, a version.
Structure
you mean, is there a version of the Dirac operator without any spinners? Well,
no, without the distinction of gamma.
Well,
without
if you,
your capital gamma.
Okay. Well, in odd dimensions, yeah, then you don't need gamma. Anyway, let me carry on. So I think that's a. Oh, there's another question. Yeah, sorry, there's another question here.
How do you define a particle from the standard model?
Oh, I'm coming to that, yeah.
The mass is spin at its own high, finite dimensional non-unitary representation of the Lorentz group.
Oh, well, I'm not going to get into that much detail, but I will come on to the quantum theory in just a minute, so. Oh, I've got to hold it. Right. Okay, so now quantum non-commutative geometry. So I mentioned particular properties. I've got the signature 2, which means I'm somehow looking at two-dimensional spaces, or at least signature 2 spaces. But actually, everything's Euclidean, so I guess I do mean dimension. Signature and dimension are the same if you're Euclidean, so I do mean dimension 2. And in this signature or dimension, j squared is minus 1. Real structure and J anti-commutes with the chirality operator. So just as in the usual physics, if you take the charge conjugate, it has the opposite chirality to the particle you started with. So then what we're going to do is have an action for each Dirac operator, and it's going to be non-negative, and then I can write down the functional integral. So the partition function . So I better explain what everything is. Well, this bit should be self-evident. I'm just integrating over the vector space of all geometries that belong to this, belong to some fixed algebra. So you fix all the other data. So the algebra, the chirality operator, the Hilbert space, the J. So they're fixed, but the Dirac operator can vary on the space of geometries for that fixed data. So this is the weight, e to the minus s of d. And I assume that as d goes to infinity in this vector space, then s gets large. So this integral will converge. And this thing here is a Berezin integral. So it's psi is an anti-commuting variable. So it lives in this vector space there, so you make them all the components anti-commute. And this thing here is known as Berezin integration. It's a vector space, so I just use the standard translation invariant measure on a vector space. Which, of course, has one undetermined scale factor, but you always divide through by a normalization when you calculate an expectation value. That cancels.
On the space G?
No, it's a vector space. There's nothing interesting.
Nothing S, whether no norm, no.
Yeah. I mean, the important point is that all the conditions on the Dirac operator are linear conditions, aren't they, Lathan? Yeah, so if you have linear conditions, you get a vector space.
Okay.
Right. So this is the fermion action here. So this is just the inner product from the Hilbert space, the Hermitian inner product. This J here is antilinear. So by the time you've used J here, this whole thing acting on psi m psi is a bilinear product. So it's bilinear in the field psi. And so the field psi bar that normally comes around, you think of, doesn't appear in this. So you only integrate over psi, and you don't need to integrate over psi bar, which you might normally do. H plus means all the fields of positive chirality. This means gamma chi equals chi. And then this integral here, you can do this, and you just get the Pfaffian of the... how can I do that? Yeah, so this integral here just gives me the Pfaffian of the Dirac operator thought of as a matrix using this anti-symmetric bilinear form to turn this into a matrix. So the Pfaffian of D is a square root of the determinant of D. And this exactly undoes the doubling, which we encountered earlier. So as you probably know, if you take the Pfaffian of a matrix, say, let's just take a simple example of this 2x2 matrix, then the answer is just A. Whereas the determinant is A squared, obviously. So this is a polynomial, but it's the square root of the determinant. And so in general, for a big matrix here, basically you only get half the eigenvalues. The eigenvalues always come with both signs, and you just product up one selection of them with one of the signs. Doesn't have to be positive, but one of them. And so this undoes the doubling. So this undoubles the fermions. And this is special to this signature S equals 2. So I'm sticking with that. And S equals 2 is what we have in physics, Euclidean physics anyway. So this is all that. This idea is out of a paper that Matilda wrote with Alan Conn and Ali Shamsuddin back in 2007 or so, is to use this Pfaffian. So I'm using it here in the matrix context. OK, what else do I want to say? Yeah, so what is the bosonic action? So that's an open issue, actually, and I don't really know the answer to this. But there's an obvious candidate to look at in the literature called the Conn-Shamsuddin spectral action. So I'm going to assume it's spectral. So what does that mean? It means that S of D is the trace of some function of D, so chi of D. So precisely that means you just sum over the eigenvalues, chi of the eigenvalues. And I want this to be positive, so I'm assuming that chi is positive. But so the Conn-Shamsuddin thing, they said use a chi like this with a cutoff. And the first thing you discover is that this doesn't work. In fact, it's pretty obvious it doesn't work because it goes to zero at some large thing here, which means the action is zero, which means that this integral doesn't even converge. And if I bothered to think about it properly, I would have realized that. But actually, Lisa did put this in our Monte Carlo simulation, and she came back 5 minutes later and said, the eigenvalues walk off to infinity. It's no good. And of course they do, because there's no cost to having the eigenvalues up here, because then the action is is zero, and the probability is one, so to speak.
Are we at fixed n now, or are we?
Yeah, fixed n.
We're still fixed n.
Yeah, so I'm fixed to Hilbert space, so fixed dimension, yeah.
So why are there infinite numbers of eigenvalues?
There aren't.
Oh.
So the eigenvalues can be big.
No, the eigenvalues can be big, and then this action will be, if you make them all big, up here, the action will be zero, and then this factor is one, and the integral doesn't converge. But basically what it tells you is that you'll get Planck scale universes. Which you could have guessed already from what's known about the Kohn-Shamsuddin action, because it has a very large cosmological constant, and that has the same effect, making the universe Planck size. So everything fits. So that isn't what it is. So we've done some experiments with the simplest thing. So. Experiments with taking S of D as trace D squared. And that's perfectly fine. And we actually get some rather interesting results off this. Hello? This doesn't work. I see. I'm not on the front board. That's the front board. Okay. I've really screwed up now. Never mind. Yeah, so we've done some experiments with this, and I'll just give you one of her results, which looks a bit like this. But if you order the eigenvalues, lambda, whatever it is, lambda something large, and then calculate in this expectation value here. So forget the fermion part, just look at the bosonic part, and we're integrating over, yeah, I forgot to put that in. So integrating the bosonic part, and we plot the average value of the nth eigenvalue when they're ordered like that. So, or the ith eigenvalue against I along here, going from 1 up to whatever the maximum is. And the funny thing happens is that what we get is an arc sine, which, whoops, goes off the board there. But anyway, the graph is arc sine. And we've absolutely no idea why. So, I mean, this is just numerical, and the curve fits extremely well. So if anybody knows why, any random matrix people have ever seen this before. You see, you might compare it with the Wigner semicircle law, but it's not a Wigner semicircle, it's something else. So I think, you know, this thing is a matrix model here, but it's a very special sort of matrix model where you've really selected very special types of matrix. So you get different results.
Do you think of it as a matrix model? What would be the restriction on the matrix you're putting?
Well, that it's a Dirac operator.
But what does that mean?
You
haven't been clear about what you mean by G.
So it's
a linear space. And
here are the relations. Yeah. So D is self-adjoint.
Yeah.
D commutes with the real structure, and then D satisfies the what's known as the first order condition, so the commutator with A and the commutator with B 0 for all A and B in the algebra, and D anticommutes with the chirality, so it D maps left to right-handed. And that's it, isn't it?
That's it.
Yeah, that's it. And you'll notice these are all linear conditions.
These what?
They're all linear conditions.
Yeah, yeah,
That's important.
So you don't have any conditions like the one that Shane was talking about yesterday, dA with dR?
No, I don't like that, you see. It would spoil everything.
Because it's non-linear.
Yeah.
So you don't agree with their...
Well, you know, for my purposes, it's not good.
So do we know the C-stress as a measure of the space of geometry, that the integral was an eigenvalue? Because it's, the entire thing is invariant under unitary transformation.
So you can turn it into... Right, so the very, very simplest example, actually, of a... not of the sort I've written here, but is where the Dirac operator is just the commutator with the matrix. And then it really with a Hermitian matrix. And then it really is a Hermitian matrix model. But the difference is the Dirac operator eigenvalues are the differences of the eigenvalues in the matrix model. So you still get a different result to the usual result.
And so do you know a geometry which has the eigenvalues?
Well, no, it's just... It's exactly the ensemble which is up there, the generalization. It's exactly what she used in her Monte Carlo.
No, I mean,
what geometry this is? No.
Some classical geometry?
No. Well, for a start, I mean, yeah, okay. So a one-dimensional space would have something like this, but it would go off, you know, infinitely in both directions. But you know. I don't know what this means. Yeah.
When you say it's not good for your purposes, do you use the nonlinear conditions? Do you just mean that you would have to choose a different measure on the path integral, more complicated?
Well, okay, you get a more complicated space, curly G, and then you have to worry about what the measure on it was, and yeah, it's just you could do it, but I don't want to. And that's the situation. Okay, so the next thing I want to talk about is Feynman diagrams. So let's take this up. That's the middle board.
So seen as a matrix model, it just with a quadratic action.
Sorry, what?
Seen as a matrix model, it just matrix with model of a quadratic action.
Well, it's not quite, because it's not the full set of matrices. It's a
constraint.
Constraint. Yeah.
But there's no interpretation.
If you use this action,
the constraint.
And if you go in the commutative case and you calculate the heat kernel expansion, I suspect the cosmological constant might diverge, no? And do you think that you're going to recover the Einstein action, like that?
Well, that's the hope, that eventually that something like that will happen,
but
yeah.
This is a calculation that can be done, right?
Well, once you understand the classical limit well enough, yes.
But if you use that as a starting point in the classical.
Oh, you lose that as a, oh, maybe. Yeah.
And just use the Gibbs book and calculate the
coefficients. Maybe. But I don't expect you'll get a cosmological constant. You see, I think the cosmological constant is precisely associated with having an operator cutoff like this, because it creates a huge pressure on the eigenvalues to go over the cutoff spectrum. And that's what gives you the large cosmological constant. Whereas in this thing here, there's no operator cutoff. I mean, the space is finite dimensional. But you can't suddenly include more eigenvalues in that window, as it were. The number of eigenvalues is fixed.
Yeah, but then so you don't have the usual argument that you get square root of GR. I mean, usually you want to get square root of GR. This is why.
Yeah, you want the Einstein-Hilbert, but you don't want the cosmological term.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
so I think.
They go hand in hand.
So I think.
You might not get it because it's infinite.
Anyway, so that's all speculation for the future. So let's come back to Feynman diagrams. So what you do here is you do perturbation theory. So you write the Dirac operator as some vacuum d0 plus d1, which is everything else. So you choose your vacuum to expand around. And then D1, you see, I can write as, because it's linear, D1 is also a Dirac operator. So I can write it as theta 1 plus J theta 1 J inverse, just like the classification of Dirac operators. And then you can plug this into the action. So obviously you get some bosonic thing, which I'm not going to talk too much about. And I'm more interested in the fermionic thing. I'll write it here, I think. So that's the kinetic term, and this is the interaction term. And then when you do your perturbation theory, you expand this into diagrams. So this diagram here will, for this kinetic term, will be a propagator. Well, actually, this term is not the propagator. This is the quadratic term you see here. So I'm just going to draw this diagrammatically like this. And my diagrams, you always go from bottom to top. So you compose in that direction. And stuff horizontally, you take the tensor product. So this means... And so this goes from... this formula here goes from H tensor H to the complex numbers. So these are particular elements in the field here, H and H. And so I'm going to say what this linear map does to these elements, and it maps it to exactly this formula there. So that's you know, the fact that's what comes out of the linear map there. And this interaction term here, the notation is like this. So this is psi theta 1 psi. And you remember that theta 1 acts on the left and j theta 1 j inverse kind of acts on the right. So this diagram here will be a right acting piece. So I'm going to have the fields in the same place. But since it wants to act on the right, I've got to wiggle it over here, and then it can act. That's right. Whoops. So that's a sort of crossing point there. That's just where the lines cross over, and this is where the action goes on. So that's acting on the right. And there'll also be bosonic vertices as well, but I'm not going to, you know, worry too much about those. You know, there'll be a quadratic piece and cubic and so on from expanding out this thing here. So we're forever thinking of theta as the variable now instead of the, or theta 1 as instead of the Dirac operator itself. So if you like, you think of theta as a connection, and the connection splits into two bits, sort of a left acting piece and a right acting piece, although the data in them is the same. Yeah, so now the propagator is the inverse. It's the diagram that goes the other way. So this maps 1 to P, which is in H tensor H. Diagrammatically, it satisfies, it's the inverse matrix to this formula here. That's the usual definition of a propagator. So in other words, it satisfies a snake identity. If I put in psi here, and then this thing here stands for this formula here, and then this thing here stands for P, and then you get psi out the top there. So I can write this thing here, and the straight line is the identity map. So that's your diagrammatics for the propagator. And then there's an elementary calculation you can do, which is to work out what this diagram means. So what is this? It's the thing that when you stick it into there gives me the interaction term. And what it has to be is you multiply them, but then you act with D naught inverse. And then this diagram where this goes on the right here is correspondingly D naught inverse. So in fact, what you get this way is your Feynman diagrams form a diagrammatic calculus. So when you do when you first meet Feynman diagrams, you just sort of draw them anyhow on the page, just anywhere around, doesn't matter. But when you do this game, you have to be really careful to draw them, going from bottom to top in the right way and taking care of the left and the right actions properly. And then you get something where the way in which you draw the diagram on the plane matters. And this is all well known, if you've done any categorical physics and you know about monoidal categories, you'll recognise these are diagrams in a monoidal category. So, you know, there's a well-developed machinery for doing this sort of thing. And I want to explain what the state sum model is. So that's the next thing to explain. And I guess I need to go somewhere. Let's take the middle one down. Sorry, what?
It's 5 minutes, okay?
Ish. Well, so let me explain. So here's an example of a Feynman diagram. And so that's something you might get from expanding your theory in diagrammatics. And then what we do is we thicken this here. So you can thicken like this. Into a surface. Okay, so blue is the boundary of the surface. And whenever you have any circle boundaries which aren't at the top or the bottom, you're allowed to fill in for free. So you thicken and you fill in disks. And what do you get? You get an oriented surface. Sitting in R3, up to deformation. And if you want the technical details, this deformation is, in fact, regular isotropy. And in fact, if you stare hard at what I've drawn here, you'll realise that what you're looking at is actually an annulus. Oops. Like that. And there's another way of thinking of it, which is that this graph is dual to a triangulation. To a sort of rather degenerate, in fact, triangulation. So what you do is that when you have, say, a trivalent vertex, you can turn that into a triangle, a dual triangle, and these gadgets come sort of sticking out, if you like, here. And then you see that this Feynman diagram is the number of triangles. In fact, there are four triangles glued together. If you glue them together in the right way, you end up with this picture again. So, so another question is, you know, it's in the question of what is S. And so now we have an even more urgent question, which is what is D naught, which is related to what is S. And I think the answer is, sort of tentative answer, is that something like the following. That you want, you really want to look at the minima. You know, you want to... you want D naught to be the minimum of the action, something like that. And typically when you do that, you get something rather degenerate comes out. So typically D naught is some constant times, no, D naught is simply plus or minus the eigenvalues, lambda naught, where these minimize, lambda naught minimize chi. And an example, would be just the constant times the one of the gamma matrices. That's an example. And that is what I sort of got surprised at when I went to, sorry, I've forgotten your name, Nazir's talk on Tuesday. He exactly had this formula of this inner product, but with a gamma naught in. So that's exactly one possible vacuum. And this is, if you like, it's a topological vacuum. I'll explain what this means. But I think that you're probably interested in, the vacuum we're interested in depends on the energy scale. And most likely this, a topological vacuum is right at the highest energy, but as you run downwards, you probably want to look at other vacua. But so a topological vacuum is something which, for which, let's say in general, which commutes with A for all A in the algebra. And now there are other vacua you might have, and for example, the standard model vacuum only commutes with a sub-algebra of the algebra.
But so.
No, no, I'm just saying this is what I call a topological vacuum. And I haven't explained why I call it that. Or topological phase, if you like. And so let's explain what this means is, what this means. where's my explanation? So if you're in such a topological phase, then... yeah, so in a topological vacuum, you've got the following calculation, that D naught times an algebra element So this is my theta 1. Well, you've always got this calculation, actually. This is always true. such a thing... so if you remember my formula here, you multiply theta 1 in, and you multiply by D naught inverse. So this is... up here, I have D naught inverse times D naught A psi, and that's just A psi. So for this particular choice of theta 1, all I'm looking at is the action of the algebra on the Hilbert space. But the point is that such a theta 1 is only a valid theta 1 in the case of a topological vacuum. That's the point. But anyway, if you have the topological vacuum, you can realize within this Feynman diagram stuff, just a straightforward diagram for the action of the algebra element A on the space. And I want to write this as... So I want to write simplified notation where I just have the algebra action. So like this, and then A psi. And obviously the opposite one, this is where you act on the other side, the right action. And then there's a vertex which you can put in your theory, which is just the multiplication in the algebra, like this. And then with this, no, I don't want this. Ah, help, help. That isn't what I wanted to do. Manual, that's the word. So how do I undo that? I want that. Sorry? That's that. That one goes up there. Right, and I've got this board here. So, so I can make the following statement. This is sort of the general thing I want to say. The axioms of non-commutative geometry are more or less in one-to-one correspondence with the topological invariance of the state sum model. And by that I mean you have a graph formed of solid lines and wiggly lines sitting inside a surface which sits inside R3. That's the particular state sum model you have. And you'll notice the dotted lines are not part of that. So you have an invariance of the surface under deformation. And I've drawn some of those before, but there's more diagrams. So for example, so the simplest thing that you meet is the following. Sorry, I'm drawing the wrong diagram. Start again. Invariance under deformation. So here's an example. Here's a simple deformation. So you can turn this into an identity. And on the top here, I just have the definition. And on this side, I have this formula. And then the equality of those two things turns into one of the axioms, or combination of the axioms, for non-commutative geometry. And you can keep doing this game. And so another sort of set of things is change of triangulation for the topological sector. the, well, I'll just say change of triangulation. I hope it's clear what I mean. So for example, this is the diagram I started drawing. So this is the associativity diagram. This is A, B, C equals, and then on the other side you associate the other way. So in triangulation speak, this this changes this triangulation into that triangulation. And you can do the same thing with a solid line in the picture. So for example, if I have a solid line here, so this then lives in the Hilbert space. There's a similar thing here. But now this is the action of the algebra on the Hilbert space, and so C becomes psi. And this becomes either AB acting on psi or A acting on B acting on psi. And in here, in the diagrammatics, we draw a line, perhaps in another colour. So you're supposed to carry around the lines with you, the solid lines for the Hilbert space. But you can do that. And so, you see, you can change the triangulation. And there's another type of topological invariance. The operation J is the half twist. So, so you have a solid line here, which is something in the Hilbert space. And you think of the surface you've constructed around it as undergoing a half twist. So this line goes over like that, and this goes underneath. So that's the picture of J. So up here you get J psi is the outcome of this linear map. and again, you know, the axioms for this come out very nicely. For example, if you do that twice, which I can just about draw. That is, in fact, by deformation, this is just this thing, line down the middle. So that's a picture of J squared. And in fact, that's already some more axioms for non-commutative geometry, because remember, you've got in here an inner product and a propagator, but actually twisted around the other, so on. and if you do it twice again, so there's sort of like this, you get the result that that's one. So you get and end up the equation at J fourth is the identity, which is also an axiom of non-commutative geometry.
So it's a claim that for any choice of action, for any choice of reasonable zero, you get the triangulation invariance or specific choices?
So for any choice of D0, you get the precise invariance for the algebra that commutes with the Dirac operator.
Okay, so what you need to choose as D so that you get only squiggle
and vertices? Oh, this here. Yeah, I haven't really explained that.
Yeah, for instance, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Because we call it a topological idiom, so that's why I'm asking, do you get topological invariance for any D0 or
for any D0 you get the topological invariance of the state sum model constructed using the algebra that commutes with that D0.
I would just okay,
so
I just characterize
which may be smaller than the algebra you started with. So D0 has symmetry breaking in it, which is, you know, one of the great things of the big mysteries of non-commutative geometry is where's the symmetry breaking. And it wasn't until I started doing perturbation theory that I started even understanding where that comes from.
But the finite algebra that you're starting with as a fixed topology, and I think the topology of that is just a bunch of points, the topology beyond A. Right? So that's when you say it's a topological invariant, of what?
Oh, I mean of this surface here. I mean, where's my...
So it has nothing to do with A. That's nothing to do with the original topology that you're starting with.
I've lost my surface.
Changes of the final diagram, which corresponds to changes of the...
Yeah, so this picture up here is a surface with a graph in it formed of solid lines for the Hilbert space and wiggly lines for the theta 1, for the connection. And what you get is an invariant of a surface with that graph stuck in it. So if I deform that picture around and move the graph with it, then I get... the same Feynman amplitude.
So you don't care about the topology of the original manifold or not?
No, this is purely an observation about Feynman diagrams. Okay. So exactly what this... You see, what we really want to study is this quantum non-commutative geometry here. And that seems to be hard. And what's easier is to study properties of the Feynman diagrams it generates. And there, surprisingly, we know a lot about it. And it seems that the study of that actually tells you everything about non-commutative geometry in the first place. And, you know, so what I hope is eventually that will tell us more about the properties of this thing, although I don't, you know...
But here the topology is fixed. If your topology is encoded in A, so if you fix A, the topology is fixed.
Not really, no. The topology is jointly between A and the Dirac operator. You can have the same A, but different
so
topologies.
In the continuous case, the Gelfand-Eymard theorem said that
Yeah, but that's special to the commutative case, and it's also special to taking continuous functions. If you just take weaker functions, then it's not true anymore. So, and here we're talking about approximating it by some finite dimensional thing, and it seems that some finite dimensional thing on its own could approximate many things. It's really a question of how you take the limits.
Yeah, usually one says that if you use a finite algebra like that, it's just a bunch of points.
Well, a finite
approximate a lot of things.
A finite commutative algebra is a bunch of points, but these are non-commutative, so it's a bunch of fuzzy, don't know what. But, so it seems pretty clear that if you just specify an algebra, you could put in a Dirac operator for a sphere, or you could put in a Dirac operator for a torus. Not fixed in advance.
So in the end, the amplitude of your Feynman amplitude depends on what? Only on the topology of the surface, or?
So right, it depends on the topology of the surface and the way that graph is sitting in that surface, topologically, but not on the details of exactly how you drew maxima and minima, and so you can move. You can move parts of the data around.
But only for very special D0. Only for the one that commutes with every element on the algebra.
So no, you see, so this thing here didn't have any of those dotted lines, you see.
Yeah.
And then it's true for everything.
So what's the role of D0? I thought your proof relied on, if you don't have D0 A commute, then you don't have the topological invariant.
Okay, so in this picture, you don't see the algebra. That's the point. You see, in this quantum non-commutative geometry, you don't see the algebra explicitly. Mm-hmm. And then it comes in a very implicit point, which is the algebra conditioned the Dirac operators. The Dirac operators satisfy a condition. Mm-hmm. So it specifies the space of Dirac operators, but it doesn't actually play any role in the calculation of after that. And so you might ask, if I'm just given this... this functional integral, how do I tell what the algebra was? If I'm just given the endpoint functions or something, can I read off the algebra? Yeah. And so what I'm saying is you can do that in the case, in this topological case, where D0 commutes with A, B0 because the algebra sitting is embedded in the theta ones by this formula here.
I guess the confusion is that you seem to have, that's not what you meant. You seem to have said that these topological invariants hold only for that particular dotted things, but that's not what you want to say. You want to say that the topological invariants is true for any D0.
Right.
This has nothing to do with this.
Right.
Okay, that was a confusion.
It's true for.
And then if D0 has this extra property, you could extract the algebra.
Exactly, yes.
But these are completely two different. Okay, they were mixed up.
Yeah, you're right. They're a bit mixed up, yes.
So topological invariants is true.
Right.
It's just these commutativity axioms of D is A.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So, you know, you see already the topological invariants here. This is your first thing that makes you suspect it is, because this is your first top. You know, it says you can straighten the string by pulling tight. And you just keep going, and you discover, you know, all the diagrams. Actually, so it's the interesting thing about this theorem here is that you almost reconstruct. So what you learn is that non-commutative geometry, the algebra should really be a Frobenius algebra, actually. So there's an extra bit of data. And it always is in this setting by just taking the trace as the Frobenius form. And you learn another thing, which is that the H doesn't have to be positive definite. That's not a topological. That doesn't come out of the diagrams. This axiom here, it sticks out as the only property of the non-commutative geometry. It has nothing to do with properties of diagrams. So it very, very strongly suggests that you should get rid of this condition. For what that's worth. Oh, and it suggests some other things. It suggests there's a generalization of non-commutative geometry, which is a non-commutative geometry in a monoidal category, which is what happens if you follow the diagrammatic stuff. And that's a genuine generalization, but that's a whole other subject. Yeah, sure.
In Walter's paper with Kahn and Chomsky, they remove the order one condition, and then when they fluctuate to that, they get a more general fluctuation. They get an extra term, which is not right or left, some strange mix. Do you know how the Feynman diagram generalizes that?
Okay. Actually, no, I haven't thought about that. That's a good question. Because I haven't tried to start with Dirac's that don't satisfy the order one condition. You see, because I need the order one condition to do this splitting here into two pieces. And when I started, I did start to try and write diagrammatics for a Dirac operator generally, but it's just a big mess, and there's nothing, you don't get anywhere. And the only place you start to get anywhere is when you split it into the sum of these two pieces. And this acts on the left and this acts on the right. So they actually have different roles in the diagram. You know, they come in different places, have different geometry. So the splitting of this Dirac into this left acting piece and right acting piece is really important. From the, you know, it doesn't, nothing works without it. So if I scrap the first order condition, I don't have this splitting, and then I don't really have a diagrammatic. So.
Well, that central term, that extra term, commutative J, so you could separate it. You could further it either as a right or a left hand if you want.
Uh-huh. Oh, I see.
Yeah,
maybe.
You can derive the order zero condition here as well.
Yeah, sure. So, the order zero condition. Well, you know, it says, what does it say? It says that this thing here is equal to, well, for algebra lines, excuse me. And then you turn that into diagrammatics, and this is just two triangles. And this is again the change of triangulation with a dotted line coming out there, a solid line going through here, I suppose. and a dotted line coming out here, and here is the other one where they go the other way. So this is a change of triangulation.
So does that mean, since you don't impose the higher order conditions, do you end up getting some like non-associativity in your diagrams for the higher order? Or?
Well, I don't have your one forms, so I don't know. That doesn't have a diagrammatic expression, so maybe you could invent one, but I haven't tried. Yeah, Raphael.
I'm going to try my question on chirality another way.
Oh, okay, yeah, right, yeah, go.
Could you get from this general framework of non-commutative geometry, could you get non-orientable manifolds?
Yes. So the work that Sarah Tavares did was on the state sum model aspect, just the state sum model for these surfaces, where you fix triangulation and there is a non-orientable version of that. I think what happens is you end up working over the real numbers. You see, so if you want to make a Möbius band, you glue the top to the bottom there. So if you just take that round like that, so that would be taking the trace of an antilinear operator. And over the complex numbers, that doesn't really make sense. But if you're happy to work over the real numbers, that makes perfect sense. So I think you end up working
on with the non-orientability of the manifold. I mean, suppose we were just doing. I don't understand quite the relation between this graphical calculus and the underlying manifold.
So if, what underlying manifold?
I mean, suppose you were doing the commutative case. Suppose you took the special case of non-commutative geometry that was commutative.
Right.
So you're just describing an ordinary Riemannian manifold.
Right.
Could that manifold be non-oriented?
Oh, I see. No, because it needs to be spin.
Spin? I don't think that rules it out. It depends on your rule.
Oh, I see.
It depends on your...
Depends on what you mean by spin.
And spin.
I don't think anybody's worked... If that exists, nobody's worked it out.
I see.
Yeah. Yeah.
That middle diagram you've got on the board with the two size and the thetas, this one here, yeah. If you replaced the theta with size and the size with theta, as in, so you've got.
You mean you have wiggly lines here?
Yes.
Yeah, but you don't have a vertex in which one fermion disappears into two bosons. Well, I got all excited in Nazir's talk because I realised that one of my vacua is you could take a gamma matrix, and that's one of these topological vacua, and that then means that you're using as an inner product the formula, the usual inner product, but with a gamma zero in, which converts the Euclidean into the Lorentzian. So I got a bit excited, and I thought, well, maybe what I'm describing is sort of Wick rotation or something. But I'm not sure it's that simple.
You also mentioned getting an indefinite metric on the Hilbert space.
Yeah, well...
That has a sort of flavor of...
Right, exactly. That's exactly what you'll get. What I tried to do for a bit was to take this formula here and then rewrite it as a new inner product that's indefinite. So for some new inner product and possibly some new J, which would then be indefinite, and then try and reconstruct some indefinite thing and say, hey, this is the Wick rotation of what I started with. But as far as I can tell, that's probably not, well, I don't know, I couldn't get it to work, so.
Well, speaking of that, occurred to me the question, is there some analog of reflection positivity in this whole framework? I mean, that's the thing which in the flat space setting guarantees the existence of the weight rotation back to Lorentz.
Yeah. I guess that's your fundamental symmetry, or whatever you call it. Fundamental involution, what do you call it? In the Krein space.
Fundamental symmetry.
Yeah, maybe that's what. So people have a Hilbert space with this operator called the fundamental symmetry, and that's the data, and you can reconstruct.
That just turns the definite to the indefinite. That's the impression I get from this.
Yeah. Maybe, yeah, I don't know. So maybe that's to do with your reflection positivity. Yeah, you mean as in the Osterwalder-Schrader business? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe.
And the action.
Yeah, I don't know. But certainly having a propagator in there is the right sort of thing. Because you can think of sort of propagating everything back to the initial hypersurface, which you can then, will then allow you to go off in the Euclidean or Lorentzian directions. But I don't know, I haven't really, don't really have an idea about that. And Saturday, and even Sunday up till middle of the afternoon.